Don himself received his J.D. from Yale University Law School. He's taught law at Stanford University, St. Louis University, and the University of Melbourne. He's been a civil rights lawyer with William Kunstler in New York and the California Rural Legal Assistance. He's been a trustee for the Poverty Lawyers for Effective Advocacy, a member of the California State Advisory Committee to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. He was director of litigation and deputy director for the San Mateo Legal Aid Society. He was police legal advisor for the San Francisco Sheriff's Department. He's been a legal consultant to the cities of Seattle, Berkeley, the state of Alaska. His books include Armed, New Perspectives on Gun Control, Restricting Handguns, The Liberal Skeptics Speak Out. I mentioned Firearms and Violence, The Great American Gun Debate with Gary Clack and others. So I'm delighted to introduce Don Cates.
Let me, as a preliminary note, for those who are interested, I'm going to be giving out a whole lot of facts. Those who are interested in footnotes, I'm such a pedant that when I write a speech, it has footnotes. Anybody who wants can ask David for my email address and write me and ask for this speech, and it'll come to you with the footnotes. Okay. To many people, it seems self-evident that the more guns there are in society, the more violence there will be. But that simply does not accord with the empirical facts. The earliest firm data we have is... it comes from right after World War II, when gun ownership was quite low, and so was the murder rate. Between 1946 and 2000, gun ownership more than doubled in the United States, that is, per capita. But the murder rate did not double, nor did it go up at all. It actually fell. So much for more guns means more violence, more murder. Neither does this work in Europe. I recently did a study with a Canadian criminologist in which we studied 16 European nations, all the nations we could get the data on gun ownership and murder. And lo and behold, the nations that had the highest gun ownership had only one-third the murder rate of the nations that had much lower gun ownership. Now, we did not conclude that more guns mean more criminals get shot and that deters criminals. That may be true. I think it is true in the United States, but it's not true in Europe because people don't keep guns for self-defense a whole lot. The reason more guns meant less murder is really irrelevant to the number of guns. The reason is this. Murder and lots of other social pathologies are caused by economic, social phenomena. And there are societies where they have these adverse phenomena and the murder rate rises. And politicians think there is a quick fix. Ban guns. Well, the problem with that is it doesn't take guns away from criminals because they don't give up their guns. And if they had no guns, they'd commit crimes with other weapons. So as a result, you ban guns, and you don't lower the murder rate. It keeps going up. As a result of that, you have a correlation. The more gun bans you have, the more murders you have. Not because the guns are being banned, but because you haven't done anything about the things which are the real cause of murder. Well, handgun control advises victims of rape and robbery to never resist in any way. Quote, "The way to keep you alive is to put up no defense. Give them what they want or run," unquote. Contrast this opinion to criminological fact. Analyzing a national data set on crime outcomes, Professor Southwick concludes, quote, "The use of a gun by the victim significantly reduces her chance of being injured." Professor Tark, analyzing a different data set of crime outcomes, concludes, quote, "Resistance with a gun appears to be the most effective in preventing serious injury to the victim and the most effective tactic for preventing property loss," unquote. Now, the uniformly anti-gun media harp on the undoubted fact that guns can cause a whole lot of problems and a whole lot of evil, and never mention another fact, which is that 6 times as many victims each year use guns to defend themselves as criminals use guns to commit crime. In other words, guns are 6 times as good as they are harmful. Now, it should be noted that most of these incidents do not involve a shooting. In 80% of the incidents where a victim pulls a gun, the criminal runs away. And that includes criminals who have guns. Now, why is this? Because criminals aren't interested in getting shot. The fact that I shot it out with that victim and he's dead is of little consolation if you're dead. A further problem is that you're much more likely, if you were a criminal, to be dead than a victim, because 85% of victims of shootings recover if you get them to a hospital. Criminals can't go to hospitals. They go to a hospital with a bullet wound. Soon they meet the police. So their chance of dying in a shootout is enormously better. Now, 7-Eleven stores follow handgun control's advice to never resist, always give them what they want. If you want to read horrible stories about women being kidnapped and raped and murdered, all you need to do is Google late night convenience store clerk and murder. You will find them in horrible and agonizing detail. Contrast a study that I published of incidents of women's armed self-defense. These are all from the year 2004. Eugene, Oregon, June 25, 2004. A convenience store clerk gave the robber all the money she had. When he threatened to kill her unless she gave him more, she pulled out her gun. He ran away. She chased him out of the store, shot his rear window out, and he was shortly captured. Haines City, Florida, August 11. Confronted in her store by 2 armed robbers, owner Judy Foster, shot one, and both of them fled. Detroit, April 29. Barbara Holland was returning to the home she shares with her 18-year-old daughter one evening when an armed man knocked her down as she was unlocking her front door and started dragging her into the house. She reported that he looked surprised when she pulled a gun out of her purse and killed him. Springfield, Ohio, March 22nd. Melanie Yancey locked herself in her bedroom when two armed men broke into her home. When they tried breaking down her door, she fired a shot through the door. They fired back. But when she killed one of them, the other one ran away. Spokane, Washington, July 29, when a man broke into her home and attempted to enter her bedroom, Lisa Hansen arrested and held him at gunpoint for police. Nashville, Tennessee, July 19, two young women hid in a bedroom with a gun when two men broke into their home. When one of the men entered the entered the bedroom, they killed him, and the other one fled. All right. There were many more of those incidents, but we have limited time, and I can see people are already going to sleep. All right. The problem with banning guns to everyone is obvious. The kind of people you need to take guns away from don't obey gun laws. So all the gun laws end up doing is disarming the victims who aren't a problem. It's important to know how gun ban advocates answer this problem. They lie. Scores of scholarly studies say, well, yes, there's burglary and rape and robbery, and those crimes are committed by criminals. But most murders are committed by ordinary, previously law-abiding people because they had a gun. That's a peculiarity of those articles is that they never cite any references. They've got footnotes for everything else, but not for that. And the reason they don't is that there are no references. Crime studies, going back as far as we have them, to the 1890s, show that law-abiding, responsible citizens, adults, do not murder, simply do not murder.
Can you pause? He's just supposed to change the tape.
Pardon? Oh, okay. Tell me when they
okay.
As I was saying, law-abiding, responsible citizens, adults, do not commit violent crimes. They do not murder. And study after study after study shows that. I am not familiar with any study that shows different. Let me cite a few of these studies. Only 15% of Americans have criminal records. Roughly 90% of adult murderers have adult records with an average crime career of 6 or more years, including 4 major felonies, and that's without accounting for their juvenile records. Among juvenile murderers, psychological studies find 80% to 100% are psychotic or have psychotic symptoms. A New York Times study of murders there in the years 2003 through 2005 found, quote, more than 90% of the killers had criminal records, unquote. In a Kennedy school study in Massachusetts, quote, some 95% of homicide offenders had been arraigned at least once in Massachusetts before they murdered. On average, homicide offenders had been arraigned for 9 previous offenses, unquote. Of Illinois murder, well, I can go on and on and on with this crap, but you're probably pretty tired, so I shall not bore you with more of it. Although anybody who's not tired can ask questions about it. And I'll read about the... the notion that murderers are criminals, I'm sorry, are ordinary law-abiding people. When you pin these people down and force them to provide some evidence, here is the evidence they provide. Invariably, it is that most murders occur between acquaintances, and many of them are in homes and in the course of arguments. Apparently, the notion is, the notion of these people, is that criminals don't have homes or acquaintances or arguments. In fact, the one national study that studied murders committed with handguns in homes among acquaintances found that the reason these people knew each other was because of, quote, previous illegal transactions. In other words, if you keep a home with lots of drugs in it, people are going to come into your home to steal your drugs and steal your money, and they're going to murder you, or you're going to murder them. And that's just the way it happened. Well, actually, if you murder, if you kill them, it's probably not murder. All right. That's about all I have to say at this point. But before closing, I want to say something about Steve Halbrook. I have been learning stuff about the Second Amendment from Steve since the 1980s, maybe 1970s. He is the definitive authority. This book, if you want entertainment reading, no, this is not your book. If you want to know everything about how the Founding Fathers passed the Second Amendment and what they thought about the right to arms, this is a book, your book. I have written in the last few weeks 2 law review articles and about the Second Amendment. And in writing those law review articles, I went through this book and took countless things out of it that I hadn't known. I'm an expert on the Second Amendment, and I still didn't know anywhere near all the stuff that Steve has in this book, and I strongly urge you to buy it if you're interested in the subject. Thank you. Sure.
Thank you, Don. We have time for questions, and the way this works is Carl has the mic, and if you will keep your comment to a question, not a statement, and hold the mic horizontal, that would be great.
I recently read that, I think it was June 12th, that a group was reintroducing to bring forth a new assault weapon ban for the United States, and wondering how that is going to fare now.
I'll take a stab at it. Don might have a comment as well. The ideal way to challenge a gun law would be a situation where all firearms are banned from a home. Back in the 1990s, the ATF directors wrote a letter to somebody in Texas saying that if you homeschool, you cannot have a gun in your home because it's a school zone and you're subject to the Gun-Free School Zones Act. And that would have been the ideal challenge to bring a Second Amendment case, but the Justice Department wouldn't defend that view, and so it never became a case. Those of us who've done strategy thought that the D.C. ban would be a good one to challenge because all handguns are banned, and that strategy ultimately did work. The thing about assault weapons is that in some ways they're the most constitutionally protective of all arms, if you're talking about semi-automatic rifles, because they're a mirror image of military weapons, although they're not fully automatic. But the press and the media and the politicians have done a wonderful job in denigrating these kinds of firearms with use of that term. And remember back the rhetoric before the federal assault weapon ban passed, they're the favorite tool of drug dealers and child molesters and terrorists, and favorite tool of, I don't know, people who do shoplifting and, you know, everything bad you could think of. So it's been difficult to challenge those laws. We've challenged them in certain states. California, you don't have a right to bear arms guarantee, but in Ohio and Connecticut and some other places, and the courts upheld those, Colorado even. I hope the time comes again when they can be challenged successfully. We know what the Heller decision holds. We don't know to what extent it would be held to apply to so-called assault weapons. But I look forward to the day when we have more case law developed that's favorable in the Second Amendment, and maybe these laws go by the wayside at some point.
Do you have an opinion about the prospects that the 5-4 decision will be reversed at some future point, and the decision may go the other direction at some point in the future?
I don't think it'll be reversed. You may have a composition of the court could be changed radically where it would be watered down, and you would have an opinion like, you know, this doesn't resolve the standard of review, for example. Is it strict scrutiny? Is it rational basis? Well, that was rejected, but it might be some intermediate standard. And what these courts did that upheld the so-called assault weapon bans were to say, oh, what a fundamental right the right to keep and bear arms is, but these are special weapons, and you can have all these other weapons to defend yourself, and so you don't need them, and they're especially dangerous and all. So if the court changes for the worse, then, yeah, you could have a watering down. It would be very, very rare to have just a blanket reversal of that opinion.
I disagree with that only in this respect. Let me actually, as a prelude, say that I'm not a Republican or a Libertarian. I'm a liberal Democrat. And I tell you, if you elect Barack Obama, the Heller decision will be reversed within his presidential terms.
What are the implications of Heller for bearing arms as opposed to just keeping arms in the home?
Well, one advantage of the opinion was that it does speak to that issue, and it makes clear that bearing means carrying. That was part of the refuting the so-called collective rights view, because that view was that bearing arms only meant in the military. And so, of course, it's all dictum, but on the other hand, I think it's going to help out in the following respect. It'd be difficult to frontally assault any state licensing requirement. I mean, the court itself sanctions licensing for carrying. And also banning concealed weapons, which was the 19th century way of regulating guns. But I think it'll help make procedures more fair. If you can say that if it's a right that's enshrined in the Constitution, then when you have procedures to obtain concealed weapon permits, let's say, that I think you'll start seeing more procedural due process, because you can say that if it's an interpretation of the law or maybe an abuse of discretion, then I think there's less room for arbitrary and capricious decisions.
Yes, I have two questions, and you can ignore and you can answer one. I have two questions, and you can ignore one at a at the decision by Scalia, at one point talking about, you know, regulating firearms on appropriate civilians or something like that. And then another, later on, I just glanced at it, but later on it talked, he was talking about how the M16 would be appropriate for a militia. It seems there's almost a self-contradiction somewhere in there. I don't know if you know that. And also, I volunteer in this a community center where two of the largest political clubs in San Francisco have their meetings. And I've heard them talk about wanting to ban firearms as to get rid of a voting block. And so how that, Don or either of you, how valid do you think that is? Do you think that's a very common reason to try to? I mean, they might use the excuse to regulate crime, but I don't know. So those are my two questions.
Right, well, as to the second, banning guns, this is a culture war issue. These people on the other side, wish to impose their views of morality on those of us who are immoral enough to want to be able to defend ourselves. And it's an interesting question whether if the Heller decision does stand, those people may just stop bothering with gun control, because their point is to get rid of guns. And if they can't get rid of the guns, they might just decide to fold their tents and go away. But on the other hand, passing more and more controls that make it more and more difficult for gun owners is something these people like. It satisfies their cultural desire to impose their views.
The lady right there.
How would that apply to California trying to ban the lead bullet?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
How would that apply to California's attempt to ban bullets?
Can't be done. I mean, we have a... I'm sorry. I'm a lawyer. I should remember that. Any shit that can be produced by man, lawyers and legislators are stupid enough to pass. That being said, and judges are stupid enough to uphold. That being said, still, there is a relevant Supreme Court analysis. There was a case in which the state of Pennsylvania had made it extremely difficult to purchase condoms. You had to do it through a drugstore. You couldn't just do it in an ordinary store, and they had all kinds of rigmarole. And this was defended on the ground that, well, it's not making condoms illegal. It's not doing anything except making it difficult, maybe. And the Supreme Court had no difficulty striking that down as a violation of the fundamental right of people to control their lives and control procreation.
Yeah, in conjunction with the previous question on the right to bear arms, there are two... bills, one in the Senate, one in Congress, to enforce 50 state reciprocity for carry permits. Either of you have an opinion on the likelihood that that's got a snowball's chance in hell of getting passed?
Well, I don't think it's going to pass anytime soon, frankly, although I think it could certainly be justified constitutionally on the basis of the 14th Amendment incorporating the Second Amendment. But those of us who live in, like, the states where people are for real or laws are, you know, reasonable, the reciprocity exists between the majority of states now, I believe. You can get what is the best permit to get? Utah. I mean, you can get a Florida permit. You don't have to be in state, and you can carry in most other states. Most states now have shall issue, and they have reciprocity with other states. I think
California.
Right, but it, but
it
you could get
shall issue.
You could,
doesn't issue.
No, right, because it's discretionary, and you can deny it to people who don't contribute to your campaign. So, but you could get a Florida license and carry in other most other states. You do have that option, or you could leave California,
which I did.
So, other than Crookshanks and Presser, what are the best arguments against incorporation for the other side?
The arguments against incorporation?
What are the best ones they can make?
There are none.
Good.
There's nothing. I mean, there used to be an argument about incorporation that said the Second Amendment is a right of the states, not a right of individuals, so it can't be incorporated. As far as I know, no one has ever made any other argument. Heller demolishes that argument, and they haven't come up with one yet. Maybe they will come up with something, but I don't think so.
Can I just add to that? Cruikshank only held that private action could not deprive people of the rights to assemble and to keep and bear arms. Presser only held that you can be required to get a license for an armed march by a military group in a city. And that it also said the First and Second Amendments don't apply directly to the states. And we argued this in the Fresno Rifle and Pistol Club in the Ninth Circuit, and we pointed out that the third case in the latter part of the 19th century, Miller versus Texas, the court explicitly said the Second and Fourth Amendments don't apply directly, and as to your argument that they apply through the 14th Amendment, you didn't make it in the court below, so we're not going to consider it. So the Supreme Court has never, ever ruled on the issue, and the Ninth Circuit said, well, it did in Presser, and it ignored Miller versus Texas. For those of you who aren't, you know, into this, sorry, but the Supreme Court's never ruled on the issue, and now it's made clear in Heller that it's reaffirmed that it never ruled on the issue.
How about here? And I'm going to go to the back.
So I was wondering if I could get some thoughts from you, if you have any, about what the future of anti-scholarship may be now in the post-Heller era.
Well, the anti-scholarship, they're very depressed and they're in disarray. They've been very smug all these years, and like I said before, they think they depicted us as crackpots, and they could, without laughing, say that the right of the people to keep and bear arms doesn't mean the right of the people to keep and bear arms. I think you're going to see a lot of money still coming in from George Foundation and groups like that. The same likely suspects will be doing, generating so-called scholarship about, well, okay, it doesn't increase the murder rate, but increases the suicide rate. And as far as rebelling against the Supreme Court decision, that started already. D.C. says they're not going to register handguns. If they're semi-automatic, they're only going to register revolvers. So this fight has just begun. It's not over.
There's a in the back.
This question is to both of the presenters. We have not talked about economic infringement, such as license fees, registration fees, and class discrimination. I'd like your opinion on economic discrimination, where you have onerous licensing fees or registration fees and a class discrimination against the poor.
I have written in an early article, an article whose conclusions Steve branded Orwellian newspeak. I said that registration and licensing were perfectly constitutional, assuming that permits were issued and registration was allowed to all law-abiding responsible adults. Now, the issue of speed and the issue of money are important issues. So let me add that New York State can have all the registration and permit laws it wants, as long as those laws provide that if a woman comes in because her ex-husband has threatened to kill her or because she's being stalked, if she comes in on Monday, New York can make her hide someplace until Wednesday and then issue her a permit, having gone through all the checks they want. And if that doesn't work for them, then they can put up more money, billions of dollars if necessary, to produce a 24 or 48 hour check. That's what I mean by registration and permits. Those are the registration and permits which I consider to be legal, not something that any of the Andes would be willing to accept.
If there's procedural due process requiring a permit to actually carry a handgun, let's say concealed or whatever, I think that's so well settled now that that's not going to be questioned, and Heller makes that clear, and it's clear under the laws of most of the states. And also the federal instant check, in which there's a 24-hour limit on the amount of time they can keep your identity and the records have to be destroyed, I don't think you'll ever see a successful Second Amendment challenge to something like that. But if it's just a pure registration requirement that you have to register to exercise a constitutional right, then I think there's potential problems with that. And my next book, by the way, is on how the Weimar Republic passed registration, and when the Nazis came to power, they used the list to disarm all enemies of the state and Jews. And so it's certainly bad policy. And whether there'll be a decision on that, I mean, most states, and certainly not the federal government, do not require registration other than for NFA firearms, for example. It's not that generally done in the law in most of our society. I don't know whether you'll ever see a successful challenge to that, but I still think as a constitutional matter to require somebody merely to possess a gun, to require them to register, I just don't see the difference in requiring Jehovah's Witnesses to register or people to register who are of some faith or political belief.
Don, don't you think that Steve was insightful in saying that he thought that fees would be twisted, as you're saying they have been?
Yes.
Right. Of course. Okay. How about right over here?
Does this Heller case now invalidate the Ninth Circuit standing problems we've had in California?
Yes.
So are Americans now going to be able to get standing to defend their Second Amendment right?
Well, we've got to go through this 14th Amendment incorporation business, too. I'm sure if Reinhardt gets your case, it's the challenge that's out here now in the public housing in San Francisco, I'm sure he'd like to invoke that same doctrine, but it'll be totally transformed. And I have to say, even in the Sylvia era opinion, Heller said that if it was an individual right, it would be incorporated like other Bill of Rights guarantees, because and he actually called the Presser decision outdated.
In the corner there?
Yeah. You know, one of my best friends is a police officer, but the truth be told, I'm very excited by this decision, because I'm hopeful that if more people can bear arms, the police are going to be more reluctant to continue their genocide of people of color and the poor. Can you, either of you or both of you, speak to the more expansive our Second Amendment rights are, the less likely that police are to break down doors without warrants, to kill people on the streets, etc.?
I think a lot of your average cop on the beat, many of them are gun owners, and they sympathize with you. And in D.C., they'll tell you to get a gun even if it's illegal, if you've been burglarized. There are police officers who misuse their authority. Traditionally, police in a repressive society, including our own, have been used as instruments of, like, white supremacy or otherwise. And certainly in totalitarian societies, they are instruments of genocide. So recognition of this right is a right against tyranny and a right involving independence and self-reliance of the individuals?
The traditional idea was the gun is the great equalizer with those who are the weakest. How about that?
If the licensing fee is exorbitant and people can't afford it, does that meet Heller?
Can you repeat that?
If the licensing fee is exorbitant, does that meet the requirements of Heller?
That goes to your point.
Well, it would, because if you have, let's say, you can restrict First Amendment assembly rights to, for example, in public places requiring permits, and I think the courts would allow for some small processing fee. But if it was a fee that was large and it was obviously intended to dissuade exercise of the right, I think a court would invalidate it, and I think that would be the case here.
What do you see the impact of Heller being on the attempt to ban ammunition in California?
Well, my understanding is, no, actually, I don't want to answer that because I'm not familiar enough with the legislation. As a general proposition, people are entitled to have ammunition for guns. That's part of the Second Amendment right. And anything that a state does to make that impossible or very difficult to exercise should be held invalid.
But I don't think if they, in California, because of the Condor thing, you know, you can't use lead ammunition in certain areas. I don't think that would ever be invalidated under the Second Amendment to use it for hunting, but to have it or possess it or to use it at shooting ranges which meet EPA standards, I think that might have Second Amendment implications.
Thank you. First off, thank you both for your hard work on this case. It's phenomenal. I am worried about one thing, though, is that I'd like to know what your guess is as to the level, assuming the this is going to be incorporated under the 14th Amendment, what the level of scrutiny required will be from your reading of the decision, because I see that as sort of the valve through which this whole our rights to the Second Amendment can be diluted, whether it'll be a rational basis or intermediate scrutiny or something worse.
Well, it won't be rational basis. That's for non constitutional rights. That's for activities that are not protected at all in the Constitution. I think it'll be considered a fundamental right. There's Supreme Court precedent saying that if it's a constitutional right, it's a fundamental right. That particularly applies to substantive guarantees in the Bill of Rights. Speech, assembly, arms bearing doesn't necessarily apply to the Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial if it's over $10 in controversy, passed in 1791. But and if that's the case, it'll be strict scrutiny and it'll be compelling state interest, all the tests that we're familiar with from First Amendment law. Could the court do something less than that, intermediate scrutiny? The court can fashion any test it wants. But one thing that's neat about this case, in the oral argument, Chief Justice Roberts said, you know, courts make up these standard of review tests. Why don't we just ask, does this law infringe on the Second Amendment? And that's what the court ended up doing.
Hi, I've got a question on the state's rights. And it seems as to me that when I travel from state to state, my First Amendment rights and search and seizure protections and so on don't change that much. But from state to state, it's this incredible patchwork of different rights, and I'm a criminal in one state, and I'm perfectly fine in the next. At what point would the Supreme Court step in and say this patchwork is intolerable and cause some kind of a federal uniformity so it's more of a seamless transition from state to state?
I think in the real long run, if we build up a jurisprudence of the Second Amendment, a lot of case law, I think that's a very legitimate point. As it stands, many states have state preemption for the same reason. You go from one city to another, one county to another, and it's a patchwork. It's like a zillion different laws within one state. And what the Supreme Court has done on First Amendment law and Fourth Amendment law is to standardize it for the whole country, to create a minimum base. And so I would hope that's where this would head, but we're right at the beginning of this enterprise, and I think this is going to go on for many, many decades before you reach a point like you're talking about.
You had a question? Okay.
What did Heller do to Miller?
You might want to explain what that means.
Do you want to address it? Yeah, you can do it.
Okay. The Miller decision is a decision in 1939 by a very stupid justice and a very careless court in a case in which only the anti-gun side was argued. The challenger was dead by then, and his attorney didn't appear. And the Miller case said, it's hard to summarize because it's hard to understand what it is, but what it basically said was you have the right to possess, or the Second Amendment right applies only to military quality weapons commonly owned among the population. This court has made it much clearer that what the right is to those kind of weapons that are owned in the civilian population. Now, if new weapons are developed, I don't know what the hell that means. But the court over and over again emphasized that handguns are the weapon of choice for very large numbers of Americans, and that's why they are protected by the Second Amendment. Basically, what Heller did as a practical matter is totally eclipse Miller. From now on, decisions are going to be based on Heller, and nobody's going to be citing Miller. Of course, I could be completely wrong. Happens all the time. But that's my ballpark estimate.
Steve, would you say that one of the reasons why what Don is saying is true, and because why the Heller decision is so important, is because this is really the first case on the Second Amendment. Would you say that's fair?
It's the first case where the Supreme Court has taken it serious.
Right.
I mean, there's reasons why we didn't have many previous cases. There was never any federal regulation until 1934, and Miller was the first effort by the court to do that, and it wasn't much of an opinion. But there haven't been any challenges that have reached the high court because there was not a circuit split like developed with Emerson and Silveira, for example, and then Heller in the lower court. So, like I said before, they're just getting started.
How about the gentleman?
What I wanted to ask about was a case that actually has affected us here in the 9th District. Those of us who suffered under the run of gun control that kept getting stuck down our throats found that when we addressed it with local bodies, and I remember the city of San Jose, we had a meeting with the mayor there, and she looked at us and said, what are you complaining about? You have no individual right. And she was referencing Hickman in 94, where it stood when it was at least applied for certain, didn't go. How does Heller affect what we're stuck with? Because that's basically when, theoretically, in this district, we lost the standing of having an individual right. And since that time, for everything we've done, without a reversal of that, we haven't had any grounds for it. And I know Emerson made us feel better, but is Heller and or the incorporation going to help us get past that? Because that's the basic standing we have now.
Distinguish incorporation. Put that aside for a moment. The Hickman opinion no longer exists. It has been demolished by the Heller opinion. Okay? Now, the Heller opinion has only held the Second Amendment applicable to the federal government. Until incorporation is decided, we don't know what applies to the states. But the Hickman opinion is gone, disappeared like the Avars, a people who disappeared so completely from Europe that for many years their disappearance was considered remarkable. And now, no one even knows who the hell they were.
Okay, one more question.
Tell us what arguments we can anticipate from the San Francisco Public Housing Authority.
The Second Amendment does not apply to the states through the 14th Amendment. I mean, that's the reason this case is brought as a test case. That's going to be their main argument. And the Supreme Court, frankly, is going to have to decide that eventually. You have Ninth Circuit precedent on the Fresno Rifle and Pistol Club case that there's no incorporation. If the Ninth Circuit wanted to do an en banc rehearing on that issue, it would have to do that. But otherwise, we're stuck with that unless the Supremes resolve the issue. That's where all this is going to end up.
If you would all join me in thanking our two speakers.